Hey everybody, welcome to the Game Buddy Funcast. I'm Sean, and always, I'm joined by Adam.
Hey, how's it going?
Our guest host today is Ryan from the Suikoden Revival Mimit.
Hello all.
And of course we got a new guest here today, Tommy the IT Guy.
Hey, how's it going?
And today's subject, I feel like we're going to talk about RPGs. Ryan, being from the Suikoden Revival Movement, I'm sure he has a lot to say on this, and we'll get into that. But first, what games are you playing? Me personally, the games I'm playing are Borderlands 2 and the new Devil May Cry that just came out, which are both equally good games. Like I said, still playing Borderlands 2 and Devil May Cry, you know, might get a lot of flack from some fans, but I personally enjoy it. What about you, Tommy? What are you playing?
Yeah, these days I'm kind of sharing my time in between playing some Borderlands 2, and also I decided to pick up the Xbox Arcade Edition of Toe Jam and Earl, trying to give that just a little bit of try here and there. It's kind of nice. They integrated some online play capabilities with it, so it looks like you're able to play with the two people over Xbox Live, so that's kind of nice. Also, checking out Minecraft, Xbox's new update. They threw some potion-making abilities in there, so I've just been kind of checking that out.
What about you, Ryan? What are you playing?
Well, right now I'm trying to get unaddicted from XCOM Enemy Unknown, which is
such a
fantastic game, really. An update of a classic, and I'm a sucker for tactical RPGs, so it's right up my alley, basically.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And other than that, I've been playing Spec Ops The Line, which is a really dark game. It's really very good, though. It deals pretty bluntly with the issues of post-traumatic stress disorder and combat stress on military members. And it's so dark it can almost be classified as a horror game. But really, I think it's very daring. I think it's very good overall. So I've been playing those two games mostly, and catching up on some indie games like Limbo that I didn't get to play earlier when they first came out. So Limbo is a fantastic game as well. Really very atmospheric. Kind of short, but for the price, I think I paid $2.50 for it. For the price, it's definitely worth it.
Yeah, I got that when it first came out. It was 15, I think, and I was one of the people that was 100% satisfied, even though it's only about 4 hours, and that's even if you get kind of stuck on it. I really enjoyed that.
On that note, actually, Spec Ops is a pretty short single-player campaign. It's maybe 6-7 hours total. So if you can, maybe rent it if you're not really sure, but I'm a sucker for interactive storytelling, really. And I think that the narrative in Spec Ops The Line is just, it's really more of a deconstruction of your classic, you know, patriotic shooter, like say Call of Duty or Medal of Honor. And you know, it's a very exciting thing to see them kind of evolve that genre.
Isn't it based on Heart of Darkness, the book?
Yeah. Joseph Conrad's
Apocalypse Now was also, I think, based on that.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is I've read the book and I've seen Apocalypse Now, and they're not blanketly ripping anyone off, actually. The ending's a little bit different than the book and the movie, so.
Yeah, I'm really interested in playing that because I've heard some really good things about Spec Ops, but I've also heard that it's pretty heavy on some of the subject matter, where it actually turns some people away.
Exactly. As I said, it can almost be classified as a horror game because you're dealing with this situation where these military forces are trying to evacuate people from sandstorms in Dubai, and you end up seeing a lot of civilians go down in pretty horrible ways, unfortunately. You know, so it's a very dark game, but if you're mature enough, if you like that kind of storytelling, you know, I think I can definitely recommend it for you. And I think, honestly, you know, I think it's better to bring this kind of stuff into a discussion, things like post-traumatic stress disorder and combat stress, because, you know, in America, we're we have a lot of soldiers coming home right now who are dealing with this kind of thing. And it's better to talk about it at least rather than just sweep it under the rug, you know?
Right.
Pretend it doesn't happen.
Yeah, very true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does that even have any kind of multiplayer component to it?
It does. It does have a multiplayer component, which is already dead. The servers, I'm not even sure if the servers are still up. In fact, about 3 weeks after the game's release, the game's single-player developers came out and called the multiplayer of the game a cancerous tumor on the disc, if you can believe
that. Wow.
Yeah.
So they were kind of just forced by the publisher to check that box on the...
Yeah, they were forced by 2K to add multiplayer, and the multiplayer was developed by an entirely different studio called Darkside Studios. And they Jaeger Entertainment was not happy with it. So essentially it was killed.
Okay. Like the cancer it was.
Yeah, more or less. And let's see, what else have I been playing? Oh, yeah, so I finally caught up to Portal 2, which was a great game. I was in China when it was first released last year, so.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I think I enjoyed it even more than the first one.
Yeah.
And I really liked the first one.
Yeah. And other than working on the Suikoden and Revival movement, I haven't had too much time to game, so that's about it for me.
All right. Adam, what about you? What have you been playing, man?
I'm still deep in the iPad zone. I've been playing... I'm still playing The Devil's Attorney, which you finally got a chance to check that out. And I'm playing Joe Danger Touch, which is a really, really fabulous version of the Joe Danger series. It started out on PS3, but I think it's on Xbox now, too.
And it's been on Xbox.
It's a really good example of being able to do a multi-touch tablet version of a console game, you know, and without sacrificing a lot of the mechanics. So really enjoying that. I'm still playing Sword and Sorcery EP, and it's really funny. I'm not stuck on it, but it's kind of a minor spoiler, but you can't complete this game unless there's an actual full moon because it relies on the calendar. So I think I have to wait like a week and a half before I could finish that game, which I think is really cool.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that's an interesting mechanic.
Yeah, or I guess you can go into your device and mess with the calendar, but the game knows, kind of like on Animal Crossing with what is his name? Resetti, or he pops out and yells at you if he sees that you're screwing around with the calendar. So I guess you technically don't beat it if you do switch around with the calendar. But there's even a character in the game, an NPC, that's like, you know, you could cheat by just going to your settings and you know, rolling. And he'll tell you exactly how many days. Like, if you roll it up 8 days, you can advance. But I think I'm just going to go ahead and wait it out because it's a pretty short game, and it's such a unique and refreshing experience that I think I could wait it out to get the whole shebang. But that's pretty much been it for me, just more iPad stuff. I played a little bit of that new Devil May Cry with you, Sean, and I was really amazed by how well done that was.
Oh, yeah, that's really, like I said, I haven't played that much because I've been busy with school and everything, but it's been going pretty good, you know? Like, I like the prettiness of the game. Like, it kind of feels like really dark.
Right. And it doesn't have like for an Unreal Engine game, it looks incredibly polished on the weirdest playing 360 version, but it's a really gorgeous game. I was really kind of taken aback by how fetching and original the visual style of it is. It's like a really interesting Western take on a Japanese title, which I was never really a huge fan of that series at all. I played the first one and thought it was okay, but I really like that. I'm looking forward to playing more of it.
Yeah, definitely. I'm looking forward to it. All right, guys. I'm going to give Ryan the floor and let him talk about what's going on with the Suikoden Revival movement right now. So, Ryan, floor is all yours, man.
All right, thank you. Well, thanks for having me on here. The Suikoden Revival movement, essentially speaking, we are an international conspiracy dedicated to giving Konami our money. Which is harder than it sounds, actually. what we're aiming for is we're aiming for essentially the revival of the original Suikoden series. So games like Suikoden 2 should be released worldwide on digital download platforms like, say, Steam, PSN, things like that. And also an eventual Suikoden 6 game, which is much needed because the story of the games, unlike, say, Final Fantasy, the story of the games is continual and has been building up and building up. And unfortunately, that story stopped at Suikoden 3. And we'd like to see the original story continue in future installments.
Yeah, 4 and 5 were prequels, right?
Yes, 4 and 5 were prequels. 4 happened about 150 years before the first game, and 5 happened about the same time as the first game. So we're looking to get that continuing. And we're also looking to see games like some of the spin-off series that they've been doing for handhelds released here in the West as well. So there was a Suikoden game released for PSP this year, actually, but it was only in Japanese and hasn't been translated to any other languages. We're looking to at least see a PSN release of a game like of that game, you know, at least subtitled, if not fully voice acted. So
yeah, I think that'd be the way to go.
Yeah. I mean, it would save a whole bunch of money because it costs tens of thousands of dollars to voice act these games at least. So, but
oh,
in
yeah,
any
definitely.
Event, yeah.
Maybe you guys could just voice act it for free.
Well, I'm not sure how that would turn out, actually.
Do it.
Yeah. Well, we've got about 8,000 likes on Facebook now, so we have a rather large pool to draw from.
Oh, yeah. International talented, pool, so.
Yeah, talented, handsome people that are Suikoden fans, for sure. We've been in operation only for about 5.5 months, and we've already hit over 7,000, almost 8,000 likes on Facebook. And just this month, we made the official PlayStation magazine for the UK on page 34.
That's
we've
huge.
Also, yeah, it's yeah. It's been overwhelming for us, actually. From the very beginning, we've been trying to get in with Operation Rainfall and start working with them. But unfortunately, things have been so overwhelming, we actually have not officially joined with Operation Rainfall yet.
Now, didn't they get some of that Wii stuff put out?
Yes,
stay behind the last story and Xenoblade and
yeah. If you don't know who Operation Rainfall is they took three Wii Japanese RPGs, and that were not going to be released in America, and they lobbied to get all three of them released here in the West, and they succeeded. Just very recently, they succeeded with their third title, Pandora's Tower.
I heard about that.
Yeah.
So Reggie finally caved.
He finally caved. XSEED got on board, and they're going to make an English language version now. So,
oh, nice.
It's really exciting time, and I think Operation Rainfall really just shows the democratization of gaming in a way. You know, just kind of like how Kickstarter and Steam Greenlight and the indie circuit show how democratized gaming has become. You know, Operation Rainfall, you know, if you get 15,000 people behind your movement, you can really make some waves in the industry. And so at first things were just completely overwhelming for us, especially when Kotaku and Destructoid.com both covered us within a week of each other. And we ended up getting about 4,000 Facebook likes from that alone. And doing all these things just kind of overwhelmed us at first. And now we're finally looking to get into the media a little bit more. And we're looking to start up our own website, just like Operation Rainfall and things like that. So,
well, the Facebook looks great. I was just looking at it earlier.
Yeah, the Facebook was the first thing that we did. And we got very talented artists to draw us some Suikoden fan art, which looks almost exactly like right. the official art.
I saw it and I thought yeah. I just made the assumption that it was from the official yeah. art.
The banner on our Facebook is done by a woman named Sierra, who lives in Indonesia, and the our profile picture is done by a woman named Denista, who lives in Bulgaria. So we are truly an international conspiracy, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, we literally cover the entire globe. The three co-founders of the Pseudocode and Revival movement are myself. I live in America. Chris, who is from Scotland, has a very beautiful accent, and Matsi, who lives in Germany. So I think that we seriously have members now from every country on the globe, except maybe some smaller countries in Africa that don't have the internet, unfortunately.
Now, where did you all meet up online?
Well, like, mostly we got started on the suicosource.com. If you want me to spell that out, it's suicosource.com. Web message board, which is basically one of the last great bastions of Pseudocode and fandom in the world, actually, because all the Japanese fan sites have shut down recently. So we met up there, and Chris and I had been working on various Pseudocode and related events for about 3 years together. And we met up with Matsi there, and we finally got very tired of trying to privately lobby Konami for a new Pseudocode endgame, and we just decided it was time to go public with our movement. And that's what we did about five and a half months ago. And it's just been, we've been enormously successful. Chris and I were two of the original founders of Pseudocode Day, which is a fake holiday that we invented where people from around the world can just gather online and talk about their love of the game and share their experiences with it. And it's very amazing to see people from every kind of culture speaking all sorts of different languages just talking about how these games change their life positively.
That's incredible.
It's really an amazing thing.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Now, have you actually made any kind of connections with like any Konami PR people yet or...
Yes, quite a few. In fact, that's actually what started the Pseudocode and Revival movement, is we had been talking with Konami. I had been talking with the American side of the company, and Chris had been talking with the Japanese side of the company for a very long time, almost 2 years together. But our conversations with them reached a dead end, unfortunately, where we could no longer keep moving up the chain of people to talk to higher and higher management. Because everyone just kept bumping us up the chain, even some of the original creators of the original Pseudocode games were just like, well, you should really talk to the upper management about this. But unfortunately, we couldn't get a hold of them, so we decided to go public with our campaign. And that was about 5 months ago, and we've had some pretty overwhelming success and been covered by major press outlets since then, so... We're really only second to Operation Rainfall itself now in terms of Facebook likes and things like that. So
I'm just kind of just hearing about it for the first time myself. So I'm just kind of just listening about your work, Ryan, to get this get Pseudocode restarted. And I really applaud you for that. Cause I know there's been some other attempts to make reinventions of some games that just didn't happen. Like I recall about 10 years ago, there was a group that tried to basically reinvent Chrono Trigger by making a 3D version. And then Square basically said, no, cease and desist because we didn't allow you to do that. The way that you're doing it's like completely right. So I must applaud you for that.
Yeah, no kidding. Actually, the funny thing is that we would actually love for Konami to sue us because we would love to get those headlines. If they, Konami sues its own, sends a cease and desist order against its own fans for trying to give it money, would be a fantastic headline for Destructoid and Kotaku. We think anyway. I don't know.
Oh yeah, that would be a huge, huge story.
Yeah.
No,
no such thing as bad publicity.
Exactly. No, right. But the people at Konami are actually really nice people. They're really amazing, and the only problem is that, one, there's obviously a language barrier between us and the Japanese side of the company, which is a pretty significant barrier. And two, they're covered by non-disclosure agreements. So they're very limited in what they can tell us about what's going on inside the company.
Right. So this series, this particular series, what is it about it that has really kind of fostered this huge community, like as opposed to the other big name RPGs, like... What is it like? Because I've never played any of them.
Yeah.
Like, What really makes it special?
Well, I think the thing that makes it special is that it appeals to so many different types of people. I mean, if you want to look at, say, compare it to, say, a modern RPG, like, say, Skyrim, for example. Skyrim is a fantastic game. I really like Skyrim. But Skyrim is based around an individual who gains this enormous world-changing power and then uses that world-changing power in whatever kind of manner he or she decides to use it. Suikoden is actually very different. Suikoden is based on the classical Chinese novel Water Margin, where 108 local bandits come together in order to fight the injustice and corruption of their local government. And Suikoden, I think the thing that makes it really stand out among other RPGs is the idea of unity and people coming together from all sorts of different races, classes, backgrounds, political beliefs, is their ability to unify and just how strong they become when they are unified. And I think that's really what makes it appeal to so many different people, is that in Suikoden, you know, you have your classical warriors, but you also have people like your innkeepers who you need to recruit, which will, you know, help you on your journey, your merchants, people like pirates and fishermen, things like that too. And they all help you along your journey, and they all make your army stronger. And I think it kind of appeals to people who, you know, don't personally feel like they fit the mold of the uber warrior themselves. And it shows them that they themselves can, you know, really be a part of something really special. Another thing that really makes Suikoden special to me is the fact that it just defies its own genre of the Japanese role-playing game. Especially lately, we've seen games take a very drastic turn towards the MMO and things like questing, grinding, you know, obviously Diablo 3, obviously Skyrim. Suikoden actually discourages grinding because you have a very limited inventory space. And it discourages, there are no real quests in the game that do not revolve directly around either plot or character development. And so what you end up with in Suikoden 2 and Suikoden 3 is you end up with 50 hours of character and plot story, as opposed to maybe 10 hours of character and plot story, and then just, you know, padded out with, you know, meaningless side quests to go collect, you know, 9 or 10 greater tortoise shells that only drop from, you know, 5% of the greater tortoises that you kill.
Yeah, like grind for 10 hours to fight a boss or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things that I think really makes them so special, is their attention to detail and their intelligence, the fact that they're meant for an intelligent audience and they treat the audience with respect, which, I mean, when was the last time you could really say that about a game? I mean, maybe you can count the number of games that made you feel that way on your hands, on your fingers. But Suikoden really treats his audience with respect and demands that they kind of think about the situation of the politics and the philosophy of the things that are affecting the characters in the game. As I said, I can talk about Suikoden for pretty much forever, but let's let Tom go, too. I mean, if you have something to say about the state of modern RPGs.
What I've kind of noticed here in the last few decades, so to speak, in my experiences with playing some of these more recent RPGs here is, my main focus here is, since I myself have played almost every single Final Fantasy title in existence, and you're correct about saying, you know, they don't actually progress through the same world every single time, with like the two exceptions where they released direct sequels for 10 and 13. And those are like the only two exceptions ever. I mean, just that alone, you get this, you know, cycle of the same, almost the same routine every game you play.
Well, yeah, I mean, especially, I mean, I am an old school Final Fantasy fan. You know, I loved all the way up through Final Fantasy VII. You know,
was you didn't just, like 8 or 9?
I liked 9. 8 was not that great, in my opinion, though, because that's kind of where they took it in the direction of the cyberpunk type of thing. And
well, they kind of did that with Seven. Seven's kind of cyberpunk, you know.
Yeah, a little bit.
But you could still get out of the city and kind of, you know, go into the wilderness. But with Eight, it was just entirely cyberpunk in this weird dystopian underpopulated future where everyone seems to be wanting to kill each other, which is
that. And the guy had a blade gun.
Yeah, blade gun.
That's right.
Blade, yeah.
The most awesome weapon ever. Yeah. The most useless weapon ever.
Yeah, like someone else had a whip.
But it looks awesome, though.
Yeah, it looked pretty cool.
Yeah, it looks cool, but...
But yeah, the battle mechanics were kind of different, and some people liked it, some people didn't. I was kind of one of those I leaned towards not really liking it as much because of the fact that you can only be as powerful as how many, like, stock of magic you had.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't like the draw system. I did not really like the draw system on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that that goes back to the whole grinding thing, is we... You know, we started in RPGs to start getting into this grinding, questing type of mode where a lot of the things that you're doing don't have anything to do with story or character at all. And that's one of the things that I find disappointing about Final Fantasy VIII is you spent so much time grinding that it feels like there was so much less story.
Oh, yeah. But you know what's a good example of good grinding, how it can be done right, is the Disgaea games for the PlayStation.
Yeah.
I do enjoy those.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those are pretty fun. I've only played the first one, and that was a number of years ago, so I think Tom probably knows a lot more about them than I do, if you've ever played them.
Yeah, I think I touched one at some point, but my memory about's very limited.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I played pretty much all of them. You know, I thought each one progressively gets better and stuff, and I do enjoy the characters. I even like Mao off the third one, which some people really don't like, but I thought his story was just hilarious. It's just all sorts of funny, and you know what you're getting into when you get those games. It's all about the grinding. They even tell you on the box, you know, you'll be grinding a lot in that.
Yeah, and then with like recent RPGs, it's like not only are you grinding, but now the story in the game itself is actually really linear, so you don't get this whole open world environment that you used to before. I've seen that with a lot of recent RPGs, like including 13. Like 13 actually shied me away from the series completely because it was just so linear.
Same with 10. I thought 10 was pretty linear as well. That's when they really changed.
Yeah, then I'm telling you, they didn't have a whole open world concept like, you know, you're used to in like all the Final Fantasies before. But what they, you know, it's just stuff like an open map that you could like warp to places. I actually got the airship, but yeah, it wasn't like the whole walk around this open world and ran across random encounters. They kind of changed it up a bit.
And that's what I miss about RPGs now. Like, I miss the open world and finding, like, the hidden stuff they put in there and everything.
Yeah, you miss
towns. And you miss towns, too, right?
Yeah. You miss. They don't really have, like, an influx of towns anymore.
Yeah, exactly. I think that has a lot to do with just how expensive it is to make an open world RPG nowadays, too. Something like Skyrim must have been very, very expensive, like maybe $50 million to make.
Well, they have like a whole symphony orchestra for the soundtrack and a choir. It's like...
Yeah. Well, the music in Skyrim is great. It's not as good as Suikoden, though, because Suikoden actually has that same thing. A full choir and symphony orchestra for its soundtracks for 1, 2, and 3, actually. So that's, you know, that's somewhat expensive, but really it's just designing an entire open world with all those textures and all those those open spaces that's just almost prohibitive in terms of cost for most developers nowadays. And I think Square really hit that with Final Fantasy X. They were kind of shocked going in how much it would cost to do that on the PlayStation 2.
Yeah, and I kind of can relate to your point there because platforms nowadays, you know, you have to be able to develop the graphics for the game, for the platform as well, whereas you have the open world environment and 2D, you know, 2D 8-bit, 16-bit, 32-bit game, you have to worry about the cost of that because you're just, you know, you're just petting a palette and then your character can just move from left to right and that was it.
Yeah, exactly. And in Skyrim, as I was saying, like, it's just this huge open world with virtually no loading times. It loads while you're going. In the PlayStation 2 era, they could do that. I mean, they did that with Morrowind on the Xbox 360, which I don't know how much that cost to develop, but it must have been a lot of money. Nowadays, what they're starting to do, though, with open-world RPGs is they're starting to use what's called hardware tessellation, where the graphics card will actually fill in a lot of the textures independently, and all the CPU and all the programmer has to do and the CPU has to do is just create a baseline wireframe and some colors to go on top of that. And with hardware tessellation, what they can do now is they can actually fill in textures for very minimal development and CPU cost. So hopefully in the next generation, we're going to see a lot more of that. And we could see some really crazy open world RPGs like, you know, Elder Scrolls 6, perhaps, that can really get back up to that Morrowind size of exploration, which I think would be really cool.
So yeah. next gen, we're probably really going to start maybe seeing that on the home consoles, you're thinking.
Yeah, it works for outside and water surfaces. Like, for example, you can't like do hardware tessellation on something like Batman, where you have a finely architectured building with gargoyles and stuff like that. You can't do that. But with things like rocks, waves, grasslands, you can
mountains,
do that.
Trees, hills.
Yeah, exactly. So does anyone want to talk about Final Fantasy 13, or are we just going to avoid that subject? Because
I kind of want to ignore that game.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
I was not now, a huge
why?
Fan of that.
I kind
of
want to hear why you guys think that, because that's Square Enix's, like, that was their last big in-house project, right?
Well, actually, their current one was actually Final Fantasy 14, but this is an MMO. I wouldn't count it. But yeah, it is. But it was around that time. Actually, I would say starting in 12, they decided to take like a whole different approach to the Final Fantasy battle system that's been classic for like the last 10 or so games. And they when they did that and chose to do so, they managed to alienate a few people that were, I wouldn't say necessarily like hardcore Final Fantasy fans, but really were into the series, such as myself. And made them look elsewhere for other you know, developers making RPGs and seeing what else was out there. And it just alienated a lot of people.
Yeah, it's interesting that Final Fantasy 13 was a hit, by the way. I mean, it sold over 5-6 million copies about. So Square Enix definitely made a lot of money on it, which it then dumped into Final Fantasy 14. And lost all of it because
they lost all of it because on the disaster.
Yeah, complete disaster. If there is one good thing I can say about Final Fantasy 13 is that I really did like the facial designs and animation.
Oh yeah, graphics were great.
They were beautiful. It's just really a tragedy that the characters dressed like they got blown by an explosion through the dumpster out back of a bondage shop and just decided to wear that.
No, wait, this is the most recent one, right?
Yeah, this is 13, yeah.
Okay, I actually, I watched a friend play that and it looked like they were just running down a hallway for hours.
Yeah, exactly,
end.
Yes.
That's exactly the gameplay is Final Hallway 13.
Yeah. The graphics are absolutely gorgeous, though. I mean, they least nailed that.
They were.
The character model. Really I like the guy with the afro. I thought he looked cool.
Yeah. I didn't like any of the characters really in that game, though. I was not a fan of like any of the characters or their stories. I could care less about them.
They didn't make any sense to me.
For myself, I actually put the game down after I played for half an hour and never turned it back on again. I knew what I was getting into. Yeah.
Wow.
So
now
they're trying to kind of salvage that. Aren't they doing like a... They're trying to do a spinoff of that already to kind of fix.
Well, I mean, they already released 13 too, which I know all they're taking about. What they're making isn't a Final Fantasy 13 Versus?
That's been in development limbo. I'm talking about they're making a 13.3 as well.
Yeah, they're making a 13.3 called Lightning Returns. I personally want to refer to it as Final Fantasy 13 Hooray for Bondage. Because that's exactly, I mean, Lightning's clothes in that game look exactly like some kind of bondage fetish outfit. And I don't know what to say about that, actually.
Are you saying like kind of how a lot of people said that Final Fantasy 10-2 is almost like the Charlie's Angels of Final Fantasies?
Yeah, this is pretty much going to be the bondage fetish fan fiction. Yeah.
Because that,
I'd rather see
that's
verse 13.
The only audience that's interested, maybe.
Yeah, Maybe I just sold the game to a lot of people. I don't know, but
oh well, I'm running out and getting it now.
Yeah, once you order, I go. I'll watch the intro movie and I'm done.
Yeah, no, but that's the intro movie is as far as I got in Final Fantasy 13 too. Actually, because I couldn't understand what was going on. I didn't understand any of the characters' motivations, why they were fighting, you know, what they were fighting for. None of it made sense. It looked beautiful, but none of it made actual sense.
Yeah, the only thing I recall from hearing from what I heard about the ending of the first Final Fantasy 13 was, I guess, Lightning. A few spoilers here.
Spoiler
maybe
alert.
The game yet. Spoiler alert. Yeah, beware spoilers. Lightning gets frozen somehow. I don't know how exactly, but apparently in the intro, she's frozen. She's unfrozen, and something happens. Other than that, I have no idea.
Yeah, and then in Final Fantasy 13, Lightning returns. I guess she's now unfrozen, and she's the only character in this new Final Fantasy 13 3 that's coming out. There's no parties or anything.
Guys, so. Help me out. Which was the one that had space volleyball in it?
You're talking about Final Fantasy, actually 10? You mean not space volleyball, was it?
It was underwater soccer.
Blitzball is what it was called.
Underwater soccer, I was
way Blitzball,
off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That one seemed like it was pretty good.
I actually like the Blitzball game. It entertained me for hours.
Really? I didn't get that into it, but I had largely given up on Final Fantasy by
that's
the time
where the,
10
That's
came
where
out.
The outfits just started to like mostly consist of like zippers and stuff, right?
Yeah, and like buttons and weird emblems and stuff like that.
Yeah, and leather mesh and stuff like that. Yeah, I don't know.
I'm convinced that like Debbie Gibson designs a lot of the character outfits in that series.
It wouldn't surprise me, actually.
Yeah, I don't really want to get into any more about Final Fantasy 13. I'm just waiting for 15 to come out now and hope they can redeem themselves. Or at least give us another Chrono Trigger or the Circle of Mana game that's been teased. Let's do something else here.
I will say this, though, real quick before we drop the topic. I am actually kind of looking forward to Final Fantasy 13 Versus. It actually looks good.
Really?
Yeah, but that's
I haven't seen anything for
Limbo
it. But...
forever.
Yeah, but once they take it out of Limbo, if they actually develop the thing, I think I'll get it.
I'd probably get it too, because you know, from what it looks like, it plays like kind of like Kingdom Hearts does.
Right.
It's like action RPG.
Yeah, there's another game in Limbo, Kingdom Hearts 3. That's been in Limbo for how many years now?
I don't know. I think we'll see something at E3 because they teased on the end of the last one for the 3DS that it was coming out. So I think we'll see something at E3 or Tokyo Game Show.
I mean, God, that was 2005 or 6, wasn't it?
No, actually, it was like 2004 or something. I think the second one came out, but
yeah, it was 2004 actually.
Yeah,
Kingdom Hearts 2.
And the thing is like they keep on releasing new Kingdom Hearts games, but it's for portable platforms, which I really don't care about because I want an actual home console. That's what I want it on.
Do you think that it may have something to do with Disney, or what do you think?
I think it may have something to do with Disney because Disney now owns Disney Interactive, which is its own independent software development, right? They make Epic Mickey and stuff like that. They may be trying to take Kingdom Hearts back away from Square Enix. Who knows?
Oh, they're still I mean, they're still making tons of money on the sequels that are released on the
portable platforms. Portables, but who knows about home consoles? They could just be, I don't know, in a state of legal limbo right now.
Basically, you know, you see the influx in the Western RPG heroes of late with solid games like Mass Effect and Skyrim and everything, and. Really, I think it's putting like the Japanese RPG pretty much, you know, in a state of flux pretty much right now because really we haven't seen too many good Japanese RPGs.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, probably one of the last good RPGs to be made by a Japanese company is Deus Ex Human Revolution, which Square Enix released because they bought out the Eidos brand. So in order for Square Enix to make a hit RPG, they had to buy out a Western developer and make a Western RPG title.
But wait, did you say it was Western or it was Japanese developed?
No, I'm sorry. It was Western developed.
Okay, yeah, I was like, whoa, I didn't know that.
But, you know, from Square Enix, a Japanese company, so.
Yeah, like I said about that purchase, I'm still waiting for Lara Croft to be riding a chocobo.
Yeah. No, I want her as a recruitable character in Final Fantasy 13.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
I want to see her in a tactics game, a Final Fantasy Tactics game.
Oh, that would be cool. Yeah.
Do a mishmash of different like Square Enix characters and everything.
Mm-hmm, yeah, exactly. No, but yeah, the JRPG has been hurting as of late, and that's mostly, in my opinion, is because when Square and Enix merged, they took with them, you know, 90% of the market in the Japanese role-playing game, and they essentially just squashed it together, you know, by making these subpar games, in my opinion, like Final Fantasy XII and Final Fantasy XIII, you know.
Now, there was either a publisher or developer that I recall a while back called, I think it was called Working Designs, and they developed or published a lot of the Lunar titles. I don't know if you heard that series or not.
No, I know that series, and I've actually been talking with Victor Ireland, who is the president of Working Designs. Now he works works for a company called Gaijin Works. He's the president of a company called Gaijin Works, which does essentially the same thing as Working Design, but only for digital platforms. So he's taking, you know, these niche, low-market Japanese role-playing games and Japanese niche games and bringing them into the U.S. and Spanish audiences. So,
oh, nice. Yeah. Speaking of digital RPGs, you guys hear about Final Fantasy All the Bravest for the iPad?
I was thinking about buying that just so I can say I have it.
It's supposed to be terrible.
It's like a cash grab, a giant cash grab.
Well, it's like what they do, I guess, is they just randomly spawn people from all the games, and they just randomly kill stuff, and that's it.
No, you gotta pay money for that first. You gotta pay money for the
$5 or something.
I think. 99 cents for a character. You don't even know who you're getting.
Yeah, and it's like random pack of random characters.
You like can get Lightning from Final Fantasy 13, and I feel like I wasted money that way.
How about a 2D version of Cloud? Yeah, that's all right.
Yeah.
What about this the rhythm game? I downloaded the demo on my iPad. It's really neat.
I was thinking about that.
See, that actually looks fun. They had it for 3DS. I'm going to have to pick it up when I get a 3DS again.
It's a little pricey because you download it and you get two songs free, and the song packs, I think, are $5 for three songs. Don't quote me on that. But it's really really interesting little rhythm game. I think it's called I don't even know how you say it. It looks like it's like the rhythm or mm-hmm. Final Fantasy the rhythm, or I don't know.
I don't know how to say that either. Yeah. I think it might be part theater and part rhythm. I don't know.
Theorhythm.
The rhythm. I'm thinking about picking that up for the 3DS when I rebuy it, so I wanted to buy all the song packs.
Right. Even though I think the 3DS version I heard has the a lot of DLC for it.
Yeah, but you actually get a meet of songs with that. It seems how it's a retail game like that. So
I think the stylus would probably be a little nicer too.
Yeah.
But it played fine, and it had a nice visual style and everything. Now let me run this by you guys. Do you think that maybe like with the Japanese RPG developers, like it may be HD growing pains, maybe?
I do kind of agree with that, just because when you're developing a game, you've got to have, you know, with these new platforms, you've got to have the great graphics to support the game as well. And with that, there's only so much you can do and fit into these graphics. And what you end up sometimes with, even doesn't matter what genre really, is you end up with a really short game with great graphics, and you're done with it in literally like 5 or 6 hours.
Yeah, I agree with that too. I think a lot of people tend to forget, especially here in the West, that Japan was actually hit harder by the stock crash of 2008 than America was. And when you add to that the tsunami in 2011, their economy just hasn't been up to par with the U.S. And making these huge games that cost, you know, $30 to $50 million to make, sometimes it's just out of the question for these companies.
Yeah, that's very true. You bring up an interesting point with the whole stock crash and tsunami and everything. I remember hearing all about that on the news and everything, because I have a couple of buddies that were still in Japan at the time, so I wanted to make sure they're all right and everything. So I can't see that as one of the reasons why.
Yeah, thankfully, I know for a fact that Konami didn't lose any employees, nor did Capcom. I'm not so sure about Square, though. Basically, Japan's had a pretty rough last few years, and I think that certainly has affected their game development and their ability to these high market AAA games. But of course, when you get right down to it, in my opinion, the AAA gaming industry is on its last legs anyway. because they're spending, you know, $40, $50 million to develop these games. Mass Effect 3 was rumored to have cost $40 million to develop, and that's far beyond the budget of most Japanese game companies right now.
That, I mean, in this industry, you spend, you know, anything over $15 million, I would even say, if you, and it flops, you're in trouble.
Exactly.
I mean, it only takes a couple of flops now in this, with the way the budgets are, and you're on your ass, you know? Yeah. So it's huge gamble.
Look at THQ, actually. They just filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and they had a number of really great games, too. I mean, I liked Darksiders. I didn't think it was the greatest game ever, but
it reviewed well. Saints Row was game of the year for a lot of people, the last one.
Exactly. And Volition Software, who makes Saints Row, they also make Red Faction, too, were worked for THQ for a long, long time and produced a number of really great games for them, including the Summoner RPGs as well. If you remember those from the early PS2 days.
I remember those. The PS2 era? Yeah, I remember those.
Yeah,
definitely. In fact, I was actually thinking about mentioning that here at some point when you're talking about Mass Effect as well, because I kind of thought the original Mass Effect had sort of like a similar play as the original Summoner, because you had a certain place you have to walk like 20 minutes just to get to an objective.
Yeah, exactly. No, I was a huge fan of the original Summoner series, mostly because I think along with Silent Hill 2, they were really some of the first really great games to come out for the PS2, which honestly had a pretty dismal launch window.
And I think Summoner was like one of the very first games released for, was it like in the initial release package or something?
I think it was a 1 week after release is when it shipped. If I recall correctly. Don't quote me on that, but I think so.
Yeah.
I think Konami should make a Contra RPG.
That could be
interesting. That would actually be really a good idea, because I mean, you could get the Mass Effect crowd in there and the old school Contra crowd, right? Because people have been jamming for a new Contra game for a very long time.
Well, they announced one at like E3 2 years ago, but they never said anything outside of the teaser trailer.
Yeah.
So I think the rumor was that it was canceled.
Yeah, Konami's had some pretty serious trouble. I mean, they've had a bad 2012. I mean, between, you know, games like Silent Hill HD Collection essentially bombing and angering into the entire fan base, and games like Silent Hill Downpour not doing so well, they really haven't had a very good year. I think that their best game this year was their best-selling game was Zone of the Enders HD Collection. Yeah.
That or Never Dead.
Never Dead actually didn't sell that well.
Oh, yeah.
I actually kind of want to – I mean, it's supposed to be horrendous, but it looked interesting to me. I would probably pick that up. I think Amazon had it for like $7.
Oh, that'd be a good $7 in my opinion.
I mean, $7, yeah. Like, that's less than like an Arby's combo meal. Like,
as bad as the game may very well be, like, I think it's so original and endearing that – you know, it'd be worth $5 to $10 to play, I think, you know.
Right.
It'd be good, I think, you know, just to mess around with, you know, at least. So, why not?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but thing is, I don't really want to play it per se, but I'd watch somebody play it. Just so I can say, I've seen this game.
Yeah, I've watched someone rip their own head off and throw it down a tunnel so they can solve a puzzle. Is essentially like some of the gameplay mechanics like that, or rip your own arm off with you know an arm that's holding a gun, and you throw that arm into a demon's mouth so it can just fire from the inside of the demon's mouth.
That sounds amazing. Like I'm starting to think that maybe the game is good.
Do that, yeah.
People are just cynical and don't like weird, cool stuff anymore. Maybe.
Well, I don't know. I mean, a lot of the critics that panned it are critics that I really like and would usually like those kind of gameplay mechanics, you know, that original stuff. But they just said that the game was just horribly broken and rushed out. And it had so many bugs that it just wasn't worth playing.
So they worked on that game for a good while, though. Like, who knows what happened?
I don't know what happened, but...
Yeah. It's actually, Horizon, I think, will save them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Metal Gear Rising is definitely going to be very good for them.
It's Platinum Games, and it's Metal Gear. I mean, the two of those put together, I think, are, you know, I think it's going to be awesome. I played the demo, like me and Adam said, it's going to be amazing.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed the demo too, and it's a very different type of Metal Gear game. But I think if traditional Metal Gear fans can really get into it, then it's really going to be a huge hit for Konami.
Well, it's going to get those Bayonetta fans too as well, and those everything, because it's made by Platinum. So
that, and I think every red-blooded 12-year-old boy wants to be a cyber ninja. That, you know,
that's true.
Cuts open giant robots with an electronic katana, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So. And you're going to have a blast doing it too, because the gameplay is actually really fun. So.
Oh, yeah. I like how it has this like little Street Fighter input movements you have on that too, and pull off different moves.
Yeah, they did a lot of that in Bayonetta too. It really does feel kind of somewhere in between what Platinum did with Bayonetta and Vanquish, which was a really good action title.
Yeah. So the Japanese game industry, in my opinion, is starting to recover, but it's going to take a while. Just simply because of the economics of the industry and the stranglehold that I think EA, Activision, and Ubisoft have on things right now.
I really think they would be wise to get into really, really being there in that the PC market with Steam, like day and date with their console releases. I think that that's something that they may actually have to do to survive, maybe next gen.
No doubt. I don't think there's any doubt that they're going to have to do that to survive. The problem with Konami, though, is Konami has always been an arcade and console publisher, never really very much down for the PC crowd. You know, because they always made, like, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle arcade games, which are great.
Sunset Riders.
Yeah, Dance Dance Revolution, again.
Oh, yeah.
And they've always designed their games around a specific controller. And so getting into the PC market for them is actually a pretty huge jump. Right. But I'm actually lobbying Konami right now to get into Steam and things like that too.
Well, your fans of kind of your more arcade-like Japanese experiences, I think they are on Steam now. That's where that audience really...
I mean,
you know, they're still there on consoles to an extent, but I really think that's like they really, really need to start getting their teams equipped to be there day and date on PC.
Yeah, no, exactly. And especially because digital platforms like Steam offer so much, such a higher return per purchase, you know, because if you ship discs to stores, you know, it's going to cost you money to make the disc.
Yeah, and you have to ship it out distributing, there. Right?
Yeah, and then you have to give money to, you know, whatever type of store, Walmart or Best Buy or wherever.
That on Steam, well. you name your you set your price, I think, on Steam.
Yes, you do set your price on Steam. That's right. It'll also help with Australian and New Zealand gamers too. Again. Many people who live in America probably don't know, but games cost, you know, 25 to even 40% more in Australia and New Zealand.
I have some really friends in Australia, and they were telling me, they're just like, it's like almost like $90 to buy a game.
Exactly. You know? And that used to be, but you know, back in the 16-bit era, that used to be because they had to ship them out there. But nowadays, you don't have to ship anything. Even there are Blu-ray plants in Australia and New Zealand now. That you can just contract out to build your game, and so there's no reason for it. It's just price gouging, really.
And to kind of bring up the topic that you bring up earlier about you know, all these companies, you know, not making a profit off of these games because they have to put so much money into it. I could just see, like, if that keeps on going that way, then eventually, what I'm kind of afraid of is that cost is eventually going to go down to the consumer. We're going to see some games here that cost twice as much as they do now.
I think that's almost inevitable, actually, is with the next console generation. I might go off on a bit of a tangent here, but in doing a lot of research into the industry for the Suikoden revival movement, I've come across some very interesting facts. I don't know if you guys remember Factor 5 Entertainment, but they made the Rogue Squadron games. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those were fantastic games. At the 2005 Game Developers Conference, Factor 5 had a long exposition on the increasing price of games, and they said that, you know, a GameCube game costs them $3 to $6 million to make. They projected that a next-gen PS3 game was going to cost them $15 to $17 million to make. In reality, Factor 5 ended up spending, I think it was $25 to $30 million to create their PS3 title Lair, which was a dismal bomb and put the entire company out of business.
I remember that. That was a kind of a crappy game.
Yeah, exactly.
But it looked gorgeous, though. You could see that money. Yeah.
And one of the things that hit the industry so hard is because even professionals like Factor 5, who were really good developers, were vastly underestimating how much it was going to cost to make these games. And as I said earlier, Mass Effect 3 probably cost about $40 million to make. And the price just keeps going up. And with the next generation, we're probably going to see $65 to $70 games, in my opinion.
Do you think they're going to go digital only on games? Because that's one of the rumors going around.
I don't think they can. I honestly don't think they can do that.
I know there are talks about that on Sony's part. They're going to release their next-gen console digital only, but then they scrapped that idea.
Because there are still so many people, like, I mean, I know it's hard to believe, but
they don't have the internet.
In the flyover states, exactly. There are still people that don't have internet.
Yeah, no internet, exactly.
Yeah, I think that right now that would be impossible. In the next console generation, that's going to be impossible. But, you know, who knows, maybe 10 years down the road it might be possible. I don't know.
I can actually see here, knowing this sort of, is that probably like in 10 years we're going to see like all these consoles have built-in like cell phone cards almost, so they can get internet access that way.
Yeah, that might work. I mean, we're going to see Steambox or Project Piston coming up here pretty soon too. I think at this next E3, they're going to unveil their Steam... Valve is going to unveil their Steambox or Project Piston or whatever it is.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, which is going to be entirely digital download, entirely digital download is one of the ways in which you can save money, you know?
Yeah. And you have the Ouya system too, that Kickstarter Android box, which looks interesting.
I got mixed opinions about that just because of – it's geared more towards the game designer rather than the consumer. So I'm kind of wondering about that.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a free-to-play or subscription-based program, and that's fine in and of itself, but I don't see that actually, you know, competing directly with Nintendo, Sony, or Microsoft, so.
Yeah, I agree there. It's going to have its own little niche market, I think.
Yeah, which could be huge.
Yeah, well, I see happening is everyone's probably going to buy one, and then after that, I just don't know where their future plans are when it comes to after they buy the console.
Yeah, I don't know either.
It's going to have like a Google store on it, right? It's run off Android. It's going to have like the Google store, right?
Yeah, it's almost like you know, it's just have Google's operating system. It's almost like, you know, it's the first, I guess you could say, console to do that, I guess.
Exactly. So do we want to talk more about Western versus Japanese RPGs?
We kind of got off topic
there.
Yeah,
we got off topic, but it's interesting. I think our conversation has been really good. But for example, like, what are the Western RPGs you guys might play?
Well, Borderlands, Borderlands 2. We got games like Mass Effect and so forth.
There's
more too. There's a lot of them out there.
Yeah, my opinion of Mass Effect, I didn't really care for it, but yeah.
Well, me personally, I've never forgiven EA for their handling of the Ultima series, for one. I mean, so ever since Ultima 9, I've basically had a ban on EA, and I haven't bought anything from them, so I'm not buying Mass Effect either.
Yeah, what I was kind of hoping is that when they released that Ultimate Collection back in the late 90s, when it contained like the majority of the Ultima titles, that was going to be more user-friendly to run on a PC, but it really wasn't.
Yeah, and, oh gosh, I'm sorry, but just all, because I bought Ultima 9 new on CD-ROM, and I didn't have an internet connection at the time, so I never got any of the patches, and you could only get about halfway through the game before it just bugged out on you and you couldn't play anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Just straight out of the box, it just didn't work.
That's not it right there. That sounds kind of horrible.
Yeah, it was a betrayal to a lot of Ultima fans like myself. But getting back to, I think, what we talked about in the pre-show a little bit more, too, is this kind of huge divide that's developed between, quote-unquote, Japanese role-playing games and Western role-playing games. And I think that...
Got games like Fallout and Elder Scrolls, you know, that are huge now. You know, really weren't so huge before. I mean, Fallout was a little bit, but then Interplay kind of, you know, dropped the ball a little bit and allowed Bethesda to pick it up.
Yeah.
And shoot out their version of Fallout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, Morrowind, Elder Scrolls 3 back for the Xbox was where a lot of people got into Western RPGs.
Oh, that was huge. I remember getting that when it first came out for my birthday. That game was huge.
That was a launch title, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't launch. It came after launch. It was released like in June, and I picked it up, you know, not knowing really what it was. Because I never played any of the other... any of the other Elder Scrolls games before that, and I've started playing that. It's like, man, there's a lot of depth here. I mean, there's like no real hand holding. They didn't tell you where to go. You're just on your own booking it, really, trying to find out what to do.
Yeah, in a huge world too.
Yeah,
it's absolutely massive.
I remember just running around and just killing little crabs and everything around along the beach just for hours, just because it's like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do.
You know. Speaking of this, there's actually one step that happened during, like, I guess, when I decided to develop a Skyrim that I wasn't a big, huge fan of, and that's when I played Oblivion. It seemed to have like its own big gameplay mechanic that I really enjoyed. Like, I'll be honest, Oblivion was the reason I bought the console I have now, was just to play Oblivion. But then here I am. I'm playing Skyrim now, and I'm thinking that, you know, Skyrim feels more like a Fallout title than it does an Elder Scrolls title, just because of the gameplay mechanics.
See, I think the reason is because they did Fallout, and they learned things. They like learned new things while doing Fallout that they implemented into the Elder Scrolls game, to Skyrim.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking that's what you're seeing the convergence on right there.
Yeah, and it just didn't feel as much like Oblivion as it felt like. I felt like I was just playing Fallout in the medieval times or something.
Fallout with swords.
Yeah. No, I mean, and there's no doubt that, you know, games like Fallout and Skyrim and Morrowind are excellent games. But one of the things I wanted to bring up to kind of bring this back to Suikoden is the fact that the difference between a Western RPG and a Japanese RPG isn't always as much as I think a lot of fans and a lot of people try to make it out to be. We talked about BioShock in the pre-show, and you know what a great game that is.
Oh, yeah.
It's essentially a shooter with RPG elements and just a masterful atmosphere to it. Wonderful art design. And how that was developed by Ken Levine, who worked on System Shock 2, along with a guy by the name of Warren Spector. And Warren Spector went on to create, after System Shock 2, he went on to create the original Deus Ex game, which is on many critics' top 10 lists of all time.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it was widely considered to be one of the best PC games ever made. And Warren Spector is one of the greatest game developers of all time, in my opinion. He went on to do, you know, he did System Shock 1 and 2, and then he did Deus Ex, and they did Epic Mickey, which wasn't as good, but I thought the first Epic Mickey was really good.
I saw an interview with him.
That was good, except for the camera, I thought.
Yeah, I heard the camera was kind of crazy.
Yeah.
I was reading an interview where he said he was trying to convince Disney Interactive to allow him to make a DuckTales RPG.
That would be fun,
that
though.
That would be great.
Because like, I love DuckTales.
Fan of the old comic books from the 60s.
Yeah, the NES game of DuckTales game was, well, loved it.
Yeah, but in any event, my point that I was getting at is that Warren Spector's favorite game of all time is the original Suikoden game, Suikoden 1 for the PlayStation. And his main influence, Warren Spector has been praised by virtually everyone for his political insight and philosophical insight in his games. His main influence in that was the original Suikoden game. And so we see... really, that there really isn't that much of a difference between Western and Japanese RPGs, in my opinion, at least. Because, you can trace a lot of things back to games like Suikoden and Final Fantasy, and then you can trace some of those influences back to, say, Ultima, and Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah, that's where they got the idea for Dragon Warrior and Final Fantasy was the original Ultima games. I remember reading about.
Yeah,
and something about
the original Ultima games were based on, you know, the Dungeons and Dragons tabletop game, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it all comes hand in hand. Pretty much, they all feed off each other. But
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and then the series that was kind of made famous for using the D&D mechanic quite well, and that's, I guess, Baldur's Gate.
Yeah.
Oh, Baldur's Gate. I forgot about that one. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then what about a Coder, right? Coders.
Knights of the Republic.
Yeah.
Yeah, Knights of the Old Republic, the old BioWare games too.
Yeah. Jade Empire. I thought Jade Empire was pretty good for the Xbox.
That was BioWare too, right?
That was BioWare.
Yeah. It's interesting that, you know, in the early 2000s, we had so many great Star Wars games. Like, the movies were terrible, but, I mean, we had Knights of the Old Republic and the Rogue Squadron games.
Yeah,
it was absolutely fantastic. Jedi Knight.
And Shadows of the Empire.
Oh, yeah, Shadows of the Empire, too. That's right. I forgot about that one. That was a great game, too.
Well, that was, like, 96, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was, like,
Right when 64 was released, yeah, but still. Post, yeah. And then I don't know was that Episode One Racer released around that time? Or was that like in the late 90s?
Well, the Pod Racer game was like 99.
That would have been 99. Yeah.
Yeah, that would have been right at the time of Episode One,
which was 99.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it was.
Yeah, I worked in film distribution at the time, so yeah, it was 99. I remember all too well the tyranny of Lucasfilm coming down on theaters, but I'm under a non-disclosure agreement about that, so I won't say any more.
I think I'd like to add a little bit on to that, the Western versus Eastern RPGs. Yeah, yeah. I do agree on your point here. I mean, it seems like now, like I said, like both sides are kind of like adapting some qualities that kind of both sides learned over the years. The only difference you're really seeing anymore is what games are released in which region.
Yeah, exactly. The Japanese are actually behind that. They don't have any faith that their games are going to sell here in the West, which is interesting because Keiji Inafune, who is one of the original creators of Mega Man, he was the top dog at Capcom for a long time, and he actually responded when the press asked him about a possible new Breath of Fire game, like a Breath of Fire 6, and he said that only very few Japanese RPG titles sell in the West, which is rather odd because Breath of Fire was a huge hit back over here. I mean, even the really bad one, Breath of Fire 5, which I didn't like at all, but they still sold well. And it was interesting to see how unconfident and insecure they are about their own game's performance over here.
Well, I think they all want that Final Fantasy VII level of success.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it was a monster hit when that came out.
Yeah,
it's huge, and I think, I don't know, like, maybe they just don't think it's worth the effort, but it's like, you're leaving money on the table either way you cut it, I think, because there's an audience for this stuff in the West.
And sometimes what you end up doing is you end up, like, scrapping a game from being released in the West altogether, and then you get the situation, like, with the series of three Enix games, Soul Blazer, and then Illusion of Gaia, then Terranigma. Terranigma never made it to the West.
Yeah, exactly. And I was
very true about that. Yeah.
And, you know,
it seemed like such a good game.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that Operation Rainfall was, you know, so heavily involved in, was no game left behind, essentially. And actually, it turns out that the last story, which Operation Rainfall was largely responsible for, is XSEED's highest-selling game of all time. It sold, like, 750,000 copies, so it worked out well for everyone.
Yeah, I'm just glad the gamers finally got their hands on that.
Yeah, and I know that in the pre-show, I was kind of mentioning that other RPG series I touched very vaguely, Shadow Hearts. See, I wasn't even aware. I was actually doing a bit of research before this, before we started talking here, and I noticed that there was a third title that was actually published by XSEED. I didn't even know it. So, yeah, I can understand that. Yeah.
But you know what seems to be doing well with RPGs with, like, the handheld systems? Like, you got the new Fire Emblem coming out early February, February 4th, I think, and you got Monster Hunter and everything coming out for portables. So,
I think these portable RPGs, the budgets are so low in comparison to like an HD game that it's like it's not as big of a risk for them to localize and and put out in Western markets and do well.
Yeah.
In my opinion, it seems like that those types of RPGs actually could, in theory, be able to do better on the market just because they're not as expensive to make.
And you can play them on the go, too, which is another plus. I mean, you don't have to have the system. You just take the little portable system wherever you're going and, you know, pop in an RPG and start playing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One of the main problems, too, is the difference in popularity between the PSP in Japan and the PSP in America and Europe, which it never really took off in Europe and America. But in Japan, it was huge.
It's still, they're still making stuff for it, too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They're still making plenty of PSP games over in Japan. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of them, even a Final Fantasy game, Final Fantasy Taibo, did not make it over to American shores, is because, you know, you just have a much, much smaller audience no matter what you do. So there are so fewer systems out there.
Yeah, very true. I said, I'm just excited, you know, about some of the prospects of next gen. Hopefully the Japanese RPG bring back its form and everything. What do you have to say about the future of RPGs, Tommy?
The future of the RPGs, I can kind of see it if the trend's kind of continuing the way it is that we're going to see a whole lot of more, I would say, like Elder Scrolls and linear games coming out. There's going to be like a division between the two. And then you're not going to really see any of the like open world concept that you've seen in like in the 80s, like the late 80s, early 90s, late 90s that we've been kind of accustomed to with some of the classic RPGs. And then we're going to be try to be convinced that this is the new wave of the way to take it. So that way, rather than having this open world concept that is really, really, well, just open world, you're thrown with all these great graphics that are in the game itself. And what you essentially do is, you know, there's that battle of, you know, graphics versus gameplay. You know, it's like one or the other when it comes to the weight. You got to have that perfect weight combination. And I see just the focus being on graphics and the gameplay not being as extensive as all the RPGs in the past.
Yeah, very true. You bring up an interesting concept, but I mean, I think it'd be horrible taking out the open world. I was hoping they'd do with the next gen, possibly bring that back, bring the whole open world concept. I mean, doesn't that be pretty, you know, CGI graphics? I'd be happy with like a nice little 2D, you know, well done, maybe sell it like 2D freaking RPG.
Yes.
I'd be quite happy with that.
Yeah, same here. I mean, that's my thought as well. It's like, I'm perfectly fine. If you're going to have me play an RPG, I'd be perfectly fine playing a 2D RPG with a great gameplay model and just taking that for hours on end. I'd be fine with that.
Yeah, if a great story, you know, as long as a great story, great characters you can relate to, you see that hero's journey.
That and 2D stuff looks so good in HD. Like,
it does.
Looks really crisp, and that's what really stands the test of time. I think you'll get those games in HD. Like, the 2D ones really stand up better than, say, something done in 3D, like, 10 years from now. The one in 2D is going to look better than the one that's in 3D.
Yeah, or even if you just do something kind of like what they did with Final Fantasy VII, and you had 3D characters on a 2D background, and that was okay with me. Or you could, you know, do something like they did, like, a little bit of upgrade when they re-released Final Fantasy III and did the 3D tweaks to it when they released it for the portable platforms. You know, you just do something like that as well. Just have like 3D block graphics. I don't need the characters to look great. I just want my game to play good.
Yeah, I just need a good story, good game, and fun mechanics. Mm-hmm. Something you can really build yourself into. That's why I kind of like the Disgaea games, just because, you know, they're in this like little 2D space. They're not 3D. And it's a great story, and you're going around and doing amazing stuff, it seems like, because they have some pretty wild attacks in that game.
Mm-hmm. It's like the series I was bringing up earlier, Lunar, like the first Lunar title was actually released for Sega CD a while back, and it was a little bit of a grind fest when it came to getting some of the items, because you had to fight like a thousand enemies just to be able to get like the next strongest weapon and armor. But the storyline was solid, and I liked the gameplay mechanics when it came to the battle system.
Ryan, do you have anything about the future of RPGs and where you'd like to see them go?
I think that the indie scene is really where a lot of really great innovations going on in the RPG right now with RPG elements. And they're showing the AAA industry that you don't have to spend $40 million on your game to make a hit. You know, you can... I'm a big advocate of the AA theory, which is essentially you spend half the amount of money developing your game, maybe $15 million, $10 million. And then you shoot for maybe a million sales instead of 5 million sales to make that money back. And I think RPGs could really do that, especially with the next gen hardware, with graphics hardware tessellation, which is going to save a lot of money. I think that the Wii U is actually a really good system, believe it or not.
Oh, that's right. We're all Wii U lovers here, except Adam, maybe.
Because
I think it's pretty good. I'm getting one eventually. I think a really good example of where I think games are going are like the Dark Souls and the Demon's Souls games. Yeah. They weren't huge budget games, but they were very well done. Graphically, they look good. They don't have the smoothest frame rates. They don't have, you know, like the most high polygon environments, but there's so much there that people love to explore and get caught up in that I think that's going to be a model for a lot of games, that, including RPGs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I think so too. I think they're essentially, you know, part of the, you know, the AA standard, the AA model for the business industry is, you know, spend much less money but create a hardcore fan base that really loves your games.
Yeah, I don't know. Actually, Ryan, actually bring up a good pointer I didn't even consider. Yes, the whole indie crowd. I myself see that's where most like gamers actually know like a good game when they see one. Basically, that's where they're going to go to actually look for the games that they want to play.
Yeah, and that's why Steam and Nintendo are so important for this next generation. Nintendo, with their upcoming Wii U shop, online shop, essentially independent developers have been saying that Wii is allowing them to set their own price. Nintendo is allowing them to set their own price.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
Just like iOS and Steam, essentially. So that's what Nintendo's really targeting, is they're targeting essentially a AA audience and an independent audience. And I think that's actually a pretty good idea. We'll see how well that works for them, especially with Steambox coming out. But
yeah, I really hope it works out, because that's actually, I consider it a really good idea.
Yeah, and, you know, because current generation costs, development costs are just through the roof, and they're going to go up with the next generation, too. They're going to go up to $60, $70 million a title. And the AAA industry, in my opinion, just can't survive. I mean, it simply can't survive.
I think outside of your rock stars and whatever, you know, EA is doing, and I think outside of that, you're just not going to see a lot of kind of mid-tier develop houses even be able to afford to make a next-gen title.
And usually what happens, they usually get consumed by the larger companies like Activision and EA anyways. That's usually the name of the game. You have these small studios, and they get eaten up by these larger companies, and I just don't think they have the same creative control they once had.
Yeah, Ubisoft is actually looking to buy THQ right now, which would, in my opinion, would be disastrous for THQ, because Ubisoft isn't a very good company, in my opinion. But yeah, so looking at the next generation, I mean, especially like what I'm trying to recommend to Konami right now is, you know, look at Metal Gear as your, and possibly Castlevania and Silent Hill as your AAA franchises. Go ahead and spend money on those. Go ahead and spend money developing and marketing them. But also, you know, take a look at some of the older series like Suikoden, Rocket Knight Adventures, Gradius, and try Contra. To maybe make, yeah, Contra, exactly, and try to make maybe AA titles with those that cost, you know, $10, $15 million to make, but will sell a million copies with the right kind of marketing, and the company will make a tidy profit, and I think everyone will win.
Yeah, that might be a win-win situation right there.
Exactly.
All right, guys, I think that's going to wrap it up for tonight on the Game Buddy Funcast. As always, I'm Sean.
I'm Adam.
And our guest tonight, Ryan.
Goodbye, all. Thank you so much. And please visit facebook.com/SuikodenRevival to join up with the Suikoden Revival movement. It's been great being here. Thank you, guys.
And, of course, Tommy the IT guy.
Hey, nice to be here, and I hope to be back someday.
All right, yeah, open invitation for anybody in this. So if you guys want to come back, just let us know, and we'll be glad to have you guys back.
Hey, thanks, man, and thank you all for listening.
Thank you, guys. All right, take it easy, everyone. Signing off.